Dublin.
When your baby leaves you all alone and nobody calls you on the phone, don't you feel like a cry? Don't you feel like a cry? For here I am, honey. Come on, you cry to me. When you're all alone in your lonely room and there's nothing but the smell of her perfume, don't you feel like a crying? Don't you feel like crying? Don't you feel like a cry? Come on, come on, cry to me. Oh, nothing can be sadder than a glass of wine alone. Walk with me. Oh, oh yeah. Then you're waiting for a voice to come in the night, but there's no one. Don't you feel like I'm crying?
Welcome everyone to Studio Soundtracks, the monthly program that takes listeners behind the scenes of making music for film, television, and video games. I am your host, Chandler Poling. In today's episode, I'm going to be speaking with music supervisor Stephanie Diaz-Matos and songwriter and composer Alex Seaver. Both have some incredible projects on TV, Fight Night with music supervision by Stephanie, and Arcane, the League of Legends animated series, Season 2 with songs written by and produced by Alex Seaver, as well as the original music. Welcome to you both. The question I have for you that I want to start out with, Stephanie, is how would you describe what it is you do? Because you have a very unique role, and I feel like as a music supervisor or an executive in any type of music fashion, it's a bit confusing for people to know the many layers involved. So curious to hear from your own mouth what it is you do.
Yeah, I mean, music supervision is certainly, I feel, a niche profession, especially those of us that are independent music supervisors. I think the easiest way to describe it, what I do, is I head of the music department for a film or television production. And what that means on the independent music supervisor side is really I'm sort of at the center of conversations with the director, with the studio, with the producer, with post-production and production. And it's my responsibility to make sure that the creative vision is clear and being executed at the highest level and being conveyed to like all the moving parts of getting a film and TV show made. And I really like the music is really everything from the needle drop you hear when there's a montage to if you have scripted lyrics and dialogue, I have to catch those and clear those. If you have on camera music, if you have a band on camera, if you have original songs needed, pretty much anything music related, I'm shepherding through the process, both creatively, logistically, and budget wise.
So I
Does that
imagine.
help at all? The understanding of the role of a music supervisor, I don't know.
Yeah, it's one of those multifaceted roles where I think maybe on the surface the public think you guys are glorified playlisters, but I know because I'm a bit more involved in the industry that there's a lot more elements to it. One thing that I find interesting is the clearance aspect, because from what I understand, it's not always a clear direction, one-way street of just like contact this person and then it happens. Is there situations, especially with your recent project of Fight Night, where you were trying to get songs placed in the show and it just was a bit of a circus to try to find out who owns the masters or anything like that? I'm always curious to hear about those stories.
I feel like you would think that licensing was straightforward, and sometimes it is, but oftentimes it's not. So on a period show like Fight Night, rights can change hands. Like through the life of a copyright, a catalog could be sold and then resold, and sort of connecting the dots and trying to figure out like who actually has the rights that we need for these older copyrights can definitely prove challenging. And we did have a song in Fight Night that was worked into the cut and used for over 3.5 minutes. It was an Otis Redding song called Cigarettes and Coffee, and it was just, in my mind, just like such a beautiful, evocative piece of music. It just really encapsulated this sort of like world-weary end of the day, end of a very long day, end of episode that we were building towards. And you think Otis Redding, like huge, no problem, his business would be all sorted out. But that was one where the copyright had changed hands, and his catalog is, various writers, different, different parties. So it's not always just like a clear, easy answer. And we had two publishers claiming the song. And normally I don't take no for an answer. So as just like a general motto in work, I don't take no for an answer. With that, sometimes creatively, I feel like, when you hit a wall, you can find a window and maybe there's a better idea that opens up new possibilities. But with this one, when we hit a wall, I was just like, it's too beautiful, it's too evocative, it's too long of a use. Like, this is the song. And I really felt it in my soul. So I had to call all the favors to get that one done. And thankfully, the studio held the line. They were not going to accept an overclaim, meaning let both publishers quote what they wanted to quote. The studio was not going to accept a TBD on splits. They wanted it sorted out ahead of time. So I was able to work with the phenomenal Carrie Ann Marshall, who's the COO of Warner Chappell, to work her magic behind the scenes so that we were able to. They did a deal with Concord that I'm sure is non-presidential and private, and whatever they did, I'm forever grateful to Carrie Ann, who's like a longtime friend, for making it so that we could keep it in the show. I think it really makes such a difference and closes like a very wild ride of an episode in like a super beautiful, emotional way.
It's so interesting because the idea of that you have to fight for the opportunity to even have a song, I'm sure situations come where you are dealing with a filmmaker and they're in love with a certain song and you already know the challenge the second they say, I'll just say Rolling Stones, but I don't know the details of their catalog, but and then you just are in that first meeting and you're just like, oh wow, I've got my work cut out for me. I'm just curious, yeah, what is the biggest challenge of your role, would you say?
I think the biggest challenge, as a music supervisor is you are walking the it's sort of like where art and commerce meet. So you have like your creative ambitions and you have your budget. And you have a lot of personalities. So how do you manage the creative ambition with the budget. Sometimes the creative ambitions are like far beyond what the budget would ever be, and that's when it gets like challenging. But it's not challenging in like a painful way or anything like that. It's just challenging in the sense it's like this masterful puzzle piece that you're con like ginormous puzzle with multiple moving parts and pieces that you're constantly trying to figure out how they all like fit together. So that could mean like, okay, we're gonna look at our budget and we're gonna look at our creative and we're gonna say we're gonna put money behind this moment and we can save in this moment. And so like it's just constant negotiations, which is like challenging because it's always you're always negotiating. I'll never forget when I was pregnant, I was like, my child's going to come out negotiating licenses because you're constantly negotiating. Like nothing is ever straightforward. You're negotiating producer deals, songwriter deals, last master licenses. You're negotiating with your director, you're negotiating with the studio, you're negotiating like you name it, there's a negotiation involved. And I think that is like that's the challenging part.
Right. Oh, I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Now on Fight Night, I wanted to ask about some of the song choices. At the top of the show, I played this song, Cry For Me, and I want to also play Cigarettes and Coffee, the track that you mentioned earlier. They both appear in episode 103, and I just want to know, was that just a music heavy episode for you? And what was it like working on that particular episode?
Well, the sort of going into the project, we knew the first several episodes were going to be music heavy because we were world building, we were establishing time and place and in a period piece that's super important. And we knew just by the nature of the story, as you got deeper into the heist and the drama, then we would move to more score heavy episodes. So when you're talking about like the negotiations, you know, when you see like, oh my God, we're spending so much money in the beginning, and then it's like, okay, have faith, everybody. We will make up for it in the later episodes. I promise there won't be like 15 needle drops per episode, every single episode. Yeah, I think the first few episodes were very music heavy, and music heavy in the sense they had on cameras. There was very long sequences. Cry For Me is like a dance performance that required like some rehearsing and playback on set. And it was fun because the showrunner and the director and the production team was like great. And like I personally love this music and like love the world that we were building. So it was great to be like super engaged for those first few, you know, early months. And then when they go off and everything score, I feel a little bit left out, but but there's something. But like I sort of thrive a little bit on the intensity. Like I thrive when there's like a lot of needs and a lot of urgency. You do get a little bit of it. You do run on adrenaline a little, particularly when you're in production. There's like a little bit of an adrenaline rush that's like getting you through like the calls that, you know, 7 a.m. call time, where's playback, blah, 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 blah. So it's fun.
Well, I want to play Cigarettes and Coffee for us right now. Here is that track.
Talking with my baby over cigarettes and coffee, and to tell you that, dog, I've been so satisfied, honey, since I've met you, baby, since I've met you. I've been around and all the good-looking girls I've met, they
to fit in. No, it didn't particularly sad. But it seems so natural, darling, that you and I are here just talking over cigarettes and drinking coffee. I say it so early in the morning. Ooh, it's a quarter till three. We're sitting here talking over cigarettes and drinking coffee, man, Lord. And I'd like to show you where I've known nothing but good old joy. You don't make it since I've met you, baby, yeah. I would love to have another drink of coffee now. And me, darling, help me smoke just one more cigarette now. Don't want no cream and sugar, cause I got you now, dog. But just let me enjoy, help me to enjoy this good time that we'll have, man. It's so early in the morning.
In the finale, you selected a song, the gospel song, Climbing Higher Mountains. Mm-hmm. It's featured on screen and it is sung by a choir. And I want to know if you could kind of explain how you're involved in the performance of on-screen elements. And is this something where if you know it's performed on screen, you obviously need to get it lined up and cleared even before you record, because you can't just do this whole production and then find out later that there's no rights allowed to it.
Yes.
So I'm just curious about the steps in order to make that happen. How early are you on in the process? How are you creatively inputting and all that goes into a scene like this?
Those things are from script phase, honestly. And the sooner you get the script, the sooner you can dive into those discussions. This 108, we got, I think we were... This wasn't a show that we had all eight scripts prior to shooting, if I remember correctly. So it is not unusual to be shooting an episode, getting a script for a later episode, and kind of discussing the needs of the episode somewhat in real time. And with this song, Climbing Higher Mountains, it was, you know, it wraps up the season really, and the message of it really speaks to, you know, contextualizing this heist as a big part of putting Atlanta on the map, which is kind of one of the underlying themes of this series in general. So, and also it's the big reveal of our character, his new path that he's found in life. Hopefully everybody's seen it, but if they haven't, I don't want to give spoilers. So it's a song that plays, diegetically, like we're in church and we hear a song, but ultimately it moves into montage, with the choir performance and wraps up many episodes. So lyrically, it was very important to find the right thing. And I will give a lot of credit to the director for identifying, like, definitely this song, and also insisting that our lead singer was also on camera. Oftentimes, you can record someone, and then casting can just place someone to mime to the pre-record. But Craig really wanted the person who was performing the lead vocal to be the person that we saw on camera, which provided, a little bit more of a challenge because then you have to consider scheduling, availability, production schedules are always shifting. And, our singer was a proper singer, so she has a life. But I have a great, I do a lot of production in Manhattan, in Atlanta. I do a lot of production in the city too, but I do a lot of production in Atlanta. And I worked with Matthew Head to do the arrangement, and he recorded the vocalist, and we found someone who could perform on camera. And really, when I watched the series back, I'm like, it truly makes such a difference because it does wrap up the episode. She does get her close-ups. The sync is perfect. And for like music heads like ourselves, I think that those are the kinds of details that I feel like really make you feel completely immersed. You're not taken out of it because there's like wonky, oh, I don't believe that voice is coming from that body or anything like that. So I think it's actually turned out really well, and I think it wrapped up the season like it was just the right note to end the series on.
Absolutely, absolutely. That last episode is pretty dynamic overall, so it's a kind of a great way to end the season. Absolutely. I'm curious now. I'm wondering, this is such an odd question. Did you always envision yourself in your role as a music supervisor from like a young age, or did you discover it as you maneuvered through the industry? How does like one become a music supervisor?
So I am of the generation before music supervision was a course in major institutions. So, but I did go to film school. So I was a dancer. I loved music. I went to film school. There was a very organic kind of merging of loves for me when it came to music supervision. But it was before there was this, before it was like sort of institutionalized. I feel like now there's the Guild of Music Supervisors, there's UCLA, there's NYU, there's like so many like formalized signals that music supervision is a thing. I have thoughts on that because I still feel like it's a pretty niche profession and not like being a doctor. But I transferred to NYU Film School with the hope of studying documentaries, and I did study documentaries, but ultimately I fell in love with the editing process, particularly how music transformed like these experimental video pieces that I was making. And I was spending a lot of time in New York City, immersed in New York City nightlife, and there was a show at the time called AMP on MTV, which played at 4 in the morning. But I called the switchboard and I asked to speak to the executive producer of the show, who happened to pick up. And he offered me an internship and ultimately a job. And that job was picking the music that played in and out of commercial breaks that they would then do these animated little things to, and kind of sequencing some videos. So it was music supervision before music supervision. And in some ways it was like my best music supervision job because I didn't know I was doing it. I was just picking, I would that was the dream job where you're like, oh, I'm just picking music. There was no negotiations because MTV had those licenses at the time. So you literally were like, if it was in their library, you could use it. So no paperwork, no negotiations, nothing. So that was the dream. From there, I went to London Records, which is where I met Randall Poster, who he had an office next to the president's office. The president, Peter Kupke, was a dear friend of his. And I just walked up to him. I was hired to do A&R and marketing, and I just said, hey, I want to do what you do. And he gave me a script, and I read it, and I came back with notes. And he said that everybody says that they want to do what he does, but nope. And he always gives them a script and he never hears from them again. But I was like, I read the script and I had thoughts, and I ended up assisting him in addition to the job I was hired for, which was A&R assistant and marketing assistant. And that relationship with Randy, at the time he was doing Royal Tenenbaums and like Velvet Goldmine and all these like amazing soundtracks. And I got to be in a record label. I got to see what kind of calls he would get, what kind of calls he would avoid. And it was, it was LimeWire and all of those, like Napster was like destroying the record industry. And so the labels fell apart, but we parted ways and then we came back together when London Records closed and became London Sire. I then followed them over to London Sire and Randy was still there. And we continued to work together. Then that label closed, and I got a job doing at an advertising agency, putting music in ads. And then Randy called me and was like, "Do you want to start a company with me?" And I said, "Sure." And it was in that first company that I really like learned the business, got access to real opportunities, and started to really understand like what my how what kind of music supervisor I am and what kind of projects I enjoy, which ultimately gave me the confidence to go out and start my own company. And then when I when my company was acquired by Radio, the decision to like say yes to this acquisition really was informed by those early days of seeing Randy in the record label office. And not just Randy, like if you look at Spring Aspers, who's at Sony, like she was also a music supervisor situated in a record label. And for me, I was like, I just loved having the energy and the access right there around me at all times. So when Issa was looking to create Radio, it just seemed like this is a great opportunity to be plugged into something bigger. And so now I'm still a music supervisor, but I also like oversee a music library, and there's a publishing division and a podcast division and all these wonderful things.
Wow. So, Alex, I just want to start with a question for you is how would you describe your role in music in media, in visual media? Because from my understanding, you do it all. You do scoring, you do songwriting, you do producing. And so just in your own words, how would you describe your role in Arcane and in general in visual media?
Yeah, I've never really come up with like a very quick answer. It is kind of all of those things. So I'm a songwriter, I'm a producer, I'm a film composer, and recently I'm an executive producer as well. So it's kind of like a awesome project comes along, it needs music and it cares about its music, and I'll just kind of help create it. And Arcane is maybe the perfect example of all of those hats getting worn at once, coming together to create something really special.
Now, when you were growing up, was there anything that you like? Did you envision yourself in this role in music? Did you envision yourself on stage? Like, how did you evolve to where you are now?
It's such a bizarre story because none of this even existed in my head as like a thing. I was a French horn player. Like that was my entire life growing up, and I was going to be a professional French horn player. I only listened to classical music. And then it took a couple big life shifts after I graduated college to suddenly be like, okay, wait a second, there's an entire other experience in music going on out there. And honestly, like the next decade and plus of my life was just stumbling into new areas that I had no idea existed and falling in love with it and getting really excited by it. And I think at this point in my career, I'm starting to actually bring all of my experiences together in music, including, popping up the French horn every once in a while for a couple cues, but just like borrowing all my life in music from songwriting and producing, composing, and making cool stuff with that.
Yeah, awesome. I'm curious, Alex, what is your biggest challenge in your role? Where do you see yourself like hitting a wall and then having to pivot and do something different and interesting.
I've never been very good at like giving up on things. So a lot of so this is a great question because it's just I am constantly hitting walls and I'm just by brute force kind of blasting through them. And I think that's one of the things that brings me so much joy in what I do is like the problem solving and the puzzle solving is so fun. And when you deal with, for example, a project like Arcane, there are so many puzzles to solve because you need to write a big commercial song with a major artist, but at the same time, have it function beautifully to picture as if it's been film scored on there. And those two worlds don't generally exist together. Music and picture have always kind of been married as soon as there's been sound in picture, but like traditional pop songwriting and film scoring is hard. And I think a lot of what you learn along the way is like how to solve those problems, how to make small pivots. And then there's definitely situations where you're like, this actually isn't intended to work. We need to rethink this from the ground up. And so you're just always kind of like learning and honing in on how to be the most efficient and spontaneous version of yourself to get these things to really speak.
Interesting. I'm curious, how do you source the artists that you work with on Arcane?
Yeah, I mean, from season one, that was kind of when we invented a lot of this. To season two was a big transformational shift for us because we doubled the amount of songs and we really wanted to go global. We wanted to think about what regions. Arcane is made by Riot Games, which also produces League of Legends, a very international video game. And so we're just thinking about what regions are important to us, what artists are important to us, how can we create a diverse soundtrack, make something that's got genres from, country artists to hip hop to K-pop to like, alt rock, and orchestral music. We wanted to marry all that stuff together. And so we just kind of hacked away at it as a team every week and kind of put every single song up on the whiteboard. How can we surprise ourselves with this song? What's a choice we could make that might be a little bit different? As you're moving through the soundtrack, you're like, what don't we have yet? What would be a cool breath of fresh air in the soundtrack? It's a 3-year process to make the thing. So we had a lot of time to really like see how it evolved and make changes as we went.
I want to play a track from the season two album by the artist Royal and the Serpent. I understand you also were a writer on this song called Wasteland. It's featured in the final episode of season two. Before I hit play, can you just set us up a little bit about what is happening with this song? Like, why was it chosen? How was it curated for this moment?
Yeah, I mean, this is probably one of the most dark and painful kind of scenes in the show. It plays sweeter, but the reality is our main character, Jinx, who's gone through the gamut of trauma and emotions and experiences, is deciding that she doesn't want to live anymore. And so this song is kind of an that very strange elegy in her head of like everything I touch is destroyed. So I'm the problem and I shouldn't be here anymore. And it's an incredibly beautiful scene because another character essentially comes in and tries to convince her, like he's seen another side of her and like she shouldn't do this, she shouldn't follow through with it. And the real tragedy is he can reverse time a little bit, so she keeps jumping off of this ledge and he keeps reversing time. And when you really think about it, it's like so dark. And Royal and the Serpent, she's an incredible artist. We were dying to have her on the soundtrack, and we actually wrote quite a few songs for different scenes with her because we just felt like her voice was a really special one. And the second she starts singing this song, you just have this overwhelming feeling of like, that's Jinx's voice. And that marriage was just so special for us. So we were really excited to kick off our finale with this one.
Beautiful. Well, here is Wasteland by Royal and the Serpent.
I've held on for as long as I can, for the ones that I had to defend. I've been strong every day of my life. If she wants, death could take me this time. This world is a wasteland where nothing can grow. I used to have strength, but I ran out of hope. I know it's my fault that I'm I could just lay my head down and rest, if there was nothing to fight or protect, maybe then I could finally be free. Maybe death is like falling asleep. This world is a wasteland where nothing can grow. I used to have strength, but I ran out of hope. I know it's my fault that I'm here alone. This world is a wasteland.
Apart from writing songs and producing the album and all of those roles that we've described, you're also a co-composer on the show with Alex Temple, not to be confused with Alex Seaver, your name, because there's two Alexes. It takes twice as much to make Arcane possible.
That's right.
I'm just curious about the dynamic of sharing duties on the score for Arcane, because I can imagine it is very complex. Not only do you have to score just the larger than life scenes we're seeing on screen, but you also have to interweave all of the songs that you've been producing and putting into the show. So how do you guys tackle that?
It's really amazing. And a collaboration like that could be so tricky. But Alex is one of the like most artistic, creative, friendly, kind collaborators. I have severe respect for him and his talent. He's literally my favorite like composer. What he can do with the orchestra is incredible, and it makes me fall back in love with orchestral writing every time I hear his music. And I think we share a lot of mutual respect, and also we sort of oversee our districts pretty clearly. Like anything song related, I'm just running, and then I look to Alex to be like, what do you need from me? Like, what do you want to score? Where are you getting stuck? Where can I chip in? And we just developed a really great working relationship where we're giving each other feedback, we're propping up each other's work, we're diving in to help when it's needed. And I at least for me, I felt so inspired by what he was doing, and a lot of the decisions he was making I would really like be thinking about when I'm writing some of the songs I was writing, and taking chances and taking risks with some of the songs I was writing, just because I was hearing what he was doing with the score.
In Arcane, the world of Arcane, at least the section that we are participating in the show, there's two worlds we're existing in. We're in the above ground and below ground, essentially. Was there distinct direction on the score of what it's going to sound like in each of those regions?
Absolutely, yeah. So those two regions you're referring to are Piltover up above and Zaun down below. Piltover being this kind of upper crust, aristocratic, you know, high, just very high class city, and Zaun being the seedy underbelly. And season one, it was kind of a clean break for us, because I would tackle most of the Zaun material, which is grungy. It uses a lot more electronic and produced elements, dark harmonic language. And Temple would take on virtually all the Piltover sequences, which was, you know, borrowing from a lot more like early and late romantic music, and just Baroque stuff was flying in there, stateliness, just beautiful, flourishy orchestral music. Season two is kind of where I felt like the line was blurred quite a lot. The show itself doesn't have such a distinction about those two cities, the narrative kind of takes a different shape, and you start more following the individual characters as they go through very subversive story arcs rather than these two worlds that are pretty like cleanly split. And I felt the same way about the score. I noticed myself scoring behind characters I actually wasn't really as involved with in season one. I mean, I spent so much time with Caitlin in season two, and she was a character that just didn't appear on my desk as much in season one. And so I think that was probably like what we all wanted out of the show, was to like start doing different things in season two than season one. And the score kind of came hand in hand with that.
What is it you learned about Caitlin in season two that you were able to bring kind of to her musical palette?
I just loved her arc. I have mentioned this before, but like I liked her in season one, but I wasn't like as obsessed with her as I was with so many of the other characters. But in season two, she might be my favorite character in season two, just because her arc is so interesting and devastating and fascinating. I mean, she was this like shiny prospect for good in season one. I guess it's a little bit like a Harvey Two-Face kind of arc, where it's like, she has this tragic thing happen to her, and it sends her into a really hateful and tragic place. And the songs needed to reflect that. I was writing songs for her, and when you do that, you're really kind of like embodying that person, because these are lyrics that they would be thinking or saying. As well as doing score material that was just starting to show a darker side of her as she started, moving from the force over to the dark side.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the characters that it gets introduced in Arcane is Abscessa. Am I saying her right name right?
Ambessa,
Ambessa, thank you.
yeah.
And she is a very dynamic, strong character from a different world, but she is kind of infiltrating Piltover and the political landscape that is there. And with it comes a really unique sound. And I wanted to play a track called Raised by Wolves that you scored from the finale 209 episode. Before I go into it, I just want to hear from you about coming up with what the sound is. And forgive me, I can't remember the land that she is from, but I imagine that was influential as well.
Big time, yeah. So that land is called Noxus. And all of this world building exists in Runeterra and in League of Legends. The people at Riot have done such a fun, creative, and amazing job at like infusing their game with a rich decade plus of lore. And so this is one of the other major regions in their world, and it's warriors, it's war culture, and it's, strength above all. It's disguising weakness and hiding vulnerability, beating it out of yourself. These are a tough, hardened people. And so the music, obviously, there was a big opportunity to make kind of a big left turn on what our traditional world building had been. And the cue itself is kind of fun, because we didn't intend it to be that at first. I wrote this big song for Ambessa. And that song is called Blood, Sweat, and Tears. We released it as like a music video prior to Arcane Season 2 coming out, to start prepping everybody that like this is going to be a big character for us. And so I put that song over the scene, and our showrunner Christian was kind of like, "This feels like too much," which happens sometimes. We have plans, and then you got to pivot because you're like, "This isn't quite what we thought." So what I did is I took this incredible gospel choir that we recorded for the song, and I basically re-recorded them and made a cue version of this to accompany her grand villain entrance in the finale.
Yeah, it's really dynamic. Well, here is the track Raised by Wolves by Alex Eber.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask of you a question that I ask all of my guests. It is, well, first of all, before I get to my final question, I wanted to ask you this question because I'm very curious. Is there any artists out there in the world that you would like to collaborate with?
I mean, the top of my list is I would love to do something in service of John Powell, whatever score he's working on. I just, if he needs a song or anything that I could be useful for, I would love to do that because he's the reason that I started writing music. And I'm just a massive Radiohead Tom York fan, so I'm a little fearful. I'm more fearful of him, where I don't want to bother a man like that whose music means like so much to me and seems like so far beyond what humans can make. But I think it would be really fun to spend a day with him and try and come up with something.
Awesome. Well, we're reaching the end of our chat, and I wanted to ask you that I ask all of the guests on my show is what was the first album you purchased, and what was the last thing you listened to?
The first out, I mean, first out like that I
That you
spent.
purchased with your own money,
I
that
know
you
that's
were
like
so
such a
excited.
that's such a hard question. Because I grew up with brothers, so I started by stealing, you
Yes.
know? I
Yes.
have like older siblings, so I started out by literally stealing their cassette tapes, like Suicidal Tendencies, Dag Nasty, like all of that kind of stuff. And then when I started buying my own cassette tapes, it would probably be like New Order Substance was like a big like game changer for me. It sort of moved me from punk rock into dance music, which then carried me through forever. And the last, let me pull up my Spotify and tell you the last thing I listened to.
Great.
Talk Talk.
Okay.
I must have been scrolling and reminded of Talk Talk, and I was like, I haven't listened to Talk Talk in a while, so I did that.
I love it. I love Talk
Yeah.
Talk.
First album I purchased, I have a vivid memory. I can't remember the name of the album, but the first Destiny's Child album. Do you know the title of that one?
Ooh, I don't. It might have just been self-titled. Was it when there was four of them?
Yep. Yeah, Beyonce was still there.
Well, no, there's like this fourth one that disappeared, and then it was Michelle, Kelly, and Beyonce for a while. But I think it's just self-titled was the first one. But now, yeah, you're making me look it
Yeah,
up.
I'm just looking it up now. It is the self-titled Destiny's Child album.
Amazing.
Okay, let's. The last thing I listened to. Okay, there's this new. Okay, Olafur Arnolds is this wonderful artist and film composer that I've been a fan of for a long time. He just started this side project that I'm absolutely obsessed with, it's with a singer named Laureen. So the name of the project is Sages, and it popped on my Spotify last night when I was driving home, and I just re-listened to this one song over and over and over the entire drive. The song is called In the Sound of Breathing. It's beautiful.
I want to thank you so much for being on Dub Lab Radio. And I'll just
Thank you
encourage
for having
everybody.
me.
Yeah, oh my gosh, it's such a pleasure. I'll encourage everybody to go listen to, I'm sorry, encourage everybody to go watch Fight Night on Peacock and listen to all these amazing songs that are placed by Stephanie and her team. And we're going to have an outro song by Alex. It is going to be titled The Line by 21 Pilots. This is a song that is featured in the finale as well, and I hope you guys all stick around and listen to it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My body's on the line now. I can't fight this time now. I can feel the light shine on my face. Did I disappoint you? Will they still let me over? If I cross the line, take a seat, but I'd rather you not be here for what could be my final form. Stay your pretty eyes on course. Keep
If I cross the line.